Hello and welcome to another episode of Gemstone Mine. I'm John, and today we have another lesson from CEDH. CEDH is a metagame within the Commander format that sits at one extreme with highly consistent, highly efficient decks. Not all cards are equally powerful in all formats, or even in all metagames, but there are lessons to be learned from how people are brewing with the most powerful cards available in Magic. As we get ready to return to in-person play with players we haven't seen in months and months at the friendly local gaming store, it's time to start thinking about our Rule Zero conversations and how we can prevent mismatched expectations and bad games. In CEDH, the critical turn is a fairly well-defined concept, which is defined by the decks which form the core of the metagame. If you're not ready to interact or going for the win on turn 3, you're falling very far behind. This reduces the chance of a mismatched gameplay between the players sitting down for a game of CEDH. How can we take this concept and apply it to other games of Commander? That's what we hope to address today. We're going to start by answering the question of what is the critical turn? We talked about this briefly in our episode on critiquing your win conditions. The critical turn is the turn in which the fastest decks in the metagame can reach critical mass and become unstoppable. The turn in which slower decks must absolutely disrupt the faster decks by, or they will lose. The turn after which the game is mathematically decided based on board position and potential threats the majority of the time. So aggro has landed its threats and sealed the game with disruption, or combo has begun to stabilize, etc., etc. In a multiplayer format, it is hard for anything to be truly mathematically decided, and the stop-and-go nature of multiplayer Magic means that in a highly interactive game, often we'll see players spending resources to try to stop the person who's actively going for it and trying to win, requiring them to back up and get set up all over again. A mismatch where one player's deck is hitting its critical turn before the opponent's decks are even set up leads to games with minimal interaction. That feeling of, well, we couldn't even do anything against your deck. The question then becomes, how do we find our critical turn? The short version? Playtesting, goldfishing, put the work in. The problem is, outside of CEDH and absent win conditions which are going to end the game on the spot, determining where the game was put on track for someone to win is fuzzy at best. When your win comes from sitting back behind Mogus God of Slaughter's damage triggers for a bunch of turns and playing defense, it can be a little tough to tell when precisely you put yourself on the path to victory. Much harder than that time I landed my turn 3 ad nauseam, barfed 15 cards onto the board and then resolved Thoracle Consult. We talked a lot about these concepts in our episode on critiquing your win condition. A better way to think of it is the point at which you are no longer just tipping the board in your favor, but warping the game irrevocably in favor of your game plan. The point at which you are no longer playing the game, but playing your game, the way your deck wants to be played. Korvold decks, for example, are landing Korvold and feeding him, drawing lots of cards, and making a big, beefy attacker. Krenko decks have their Krenko online and ready to start making oodles of goblins. Aristocrats decks have their sac outlets set up and their blood artists ready to go. Essentially, the setup is done, now it's time to get paid. Now it's time for the game to go the way I want it to go. When it comes time for us to actually estimate our critical turn, we start by looking at the setup cost. How efficient can we be when we're going for it? Start by looking at the mana value of the card that really is going to turn the tables in your favor. Craterhoof Behemoth, for example, costs 5 green. It does have an additional setup cost of needing multiple bodies already on the board, but honestly, for a green deck, this is a pretty light restriction. An even lighter restriction is on Thassa's Oracle and Demonic Consultation. We did a combo breakdown on this here. For a cost of blue, black, you can go for it as soon as you can produce these 3 mana. No setup cost is needed as soon as you have those 2 cards in your hand, and an otherwise empty board? Doesn't matter. You can win from there. I mentioned goldfishing before. Goldfishing your deck can give you an estimate of how quickly you can reach and achieve this ultimate end step for your deck. Goldfishing comes back to the idea of simply sitting down with your deck, shuffling it up, and playing opening hands and just getting a sense of what your deck plays like on those early turns of the game. Essentially, can I play my deck against my pet goldfish? You may find out in playtesting and goldfishing that while it may cost 5 green to play Craterhoof, your elf tribal deck may be able to consistently make that mana by turn 5. Similarly, if you're running lots of broken mana rocks like Mox Diamond and Chrome Mox, it can be very easy to hit large amounts of mana very quickly. Efficiency isn't the only piece of the puzzle, though. We also look at consistency. How consistently can you get to your end state of your deck? How many tutors are you running to find your win condition, or find your deck's core engine and game plan? Each card you draw in a game of Commander is just over a 1% chance for it to be the particular card you need to go for it. Each tutor you have in your deck doubles the chance of finding a line to that particular card. Breaking out the hypergeometric calculator reinforces this. If your plan is to win by hoofing it, by the time you get to turn 8 and run no tutors, you'll have naturally drawn 16 cards, giving you a 16.2% chance to hit your hoof. Running a single tutor almost doubles this chance, up to 29.8%. Running two tutors gets you to 41.4%, and running three gets you up to 51.2%. Redundancy works in a similar way. If you have multiple redundant cards which can fill in the role of your win condition, your chances to hit one of those pieces increases significantly. If you remember good old 8x8 theory, running 8 redundant copies of an effect in a particular package gets you to a 77% chance to have seen at least one of them after drawing a total of 16 cards, 7 in your opener, and then 1 for each turn after that. If your particular game plan revolves around not just a single card, but needs multiple cards to be able to make it work, this significantly decreases the consistency of your deck. My God Eternal Oketra deck is a pretty good example of this. This is my Scrappy Cat deck, which runs 7 different artifact getter backers who can start to form loops to create my multiple zombie warriors, those big 4/4 beefy boys with vigilance each turn. But I need at least 2 of those getter backers in order to get a loop going. Further, I also need access to a sacrifice outlet to be able to consistently get a graveyard getter backer into the graveyard and begin triggering to return the other ones to my hand. This deck is running 3 tutors that I can use to grab a missing getter backer. Running this through a hypergeometric calculator, I'll need to see at least 21 cards from my deck before I have a reasonable 67% chance to have assembled the 2 getter backers, and that's still not accounting for the need to also have a sacrifice outlet. This means that I'll need to generate at least the 3 white-white needed to cast Oketra, protect her, and then have drawn 7 extra cards by turn 6 to have what I need in hand to start looping creatures and making a large number of zombie tokens. This is my critical turn, the time by which I can start really cranking out threats and putting the balance of the game in my favor. This is interesting because from a deck-building standpoint, it tells me I really need to have a lot of card draw in order to make Oketra really purr. On the other hand, from a gameplay standpoint and the ability to have a meaningful Rule Zero conversation, it tells me that I want to identify turn 6 as my deck's likely critical turn. But that's not the end of the story. Looking at how long it takes to actually win and how vulnerable the win is once we start to go for it matters as well. We have to answer the question of how hard is it for our opponents to beat us when we're going for it? How long is the clock that we're going to present? How many times will a given opponent get to untap to answer your win condition? In most cases, a Craterhoof Behemoth has a clock of 0. You cast it, then everyone gets trampled. A Voltron deck, which can knock an opponent out in 3 hits, would generally be said to have a clock of 3. We're not just considering this from our standpoint, where it actually takes about 9 turns for us to end the game this way, but from the perspective of our opponents. How long will they have to be able to save themselves in the event that you turn your Voltron commander on them first? How many chances will they get to interact before they're knocked out of the game? How often will they be left in the situation where they will say, "I didn't feel like there was anything I could do against your deck," the feeling that we're looking to avoid with our Rule Zero conversation? Apart from just the clock of your win condition, consider the surface area you present when you're going for it. A surface area is a rough estimate of how easily your opponents can interact with your plan. What types of answers is it vulnerable to? Are you only vulnerable to counterspells, in the case of Thassa's Oracle and Demonic Consultation? Is it something where it's only really vulnerable to instant speed enchantment removal? Is it something that's only going to be vulnerable to creature or artifact removal at instant speed? Can it be stopped by something as simple as having blockers? Each one of these things tells a very different story and presents your opponents different options to interact with you when you are going for it. If we're looking for a good interactive game with a lot of stop and go, having a wider surface area in addition to having a longer clock is going to present your opponents more opportunities to interact with you and give us that more interactive experience that we're looking for. The larger the surface area you present and the longer the clock you present, the less likely your opponents will feel overwhelmed. This can be a way to tune your deck when it already is very efficient and very consistent. By having a relatively low critical turn, you may want to make sure that your clock is very long and you have a very wide and broad surface area for your opponents to interact with. The more chances you give your opponents to draw into an answer, the more they feel like they're going to be interacting with you in a meaningful way, and the better your games are going to be overall. Now, you may be asking yourself, what if I don't have a hard and fast win condition in my deck? The question you're asking yourself when you're looking for your critical turn is not, when am I going to win? The better question is, when am I going to start getting paid off by my deck for all the setup I did? In our episode on Ready, Set, Go, we talked about the setup stage being the first time you can multispell, when you can both develop your own game plan and interact with your opponent's game plan. You can think of when you go for it as when your deck is paying you off for all of your hard work during the setup stage. Let's look at a few examples of different commanders and try to estimate what their critical turn may be based on how they're often built. Omnath, Locus of Rage, is a classic example. When you cast Omnath and can start triggering multiple landfall triggers to generate your army of elementals, you have really warped the game in your favor. Being a ramp deck in green, you probably don't need to wait until turn 7 to cast Omnath. Looking at your ramp package, goldfish a few hands. Keep track of when you're able to cast Omnath and then drop an additional land or two. If you're casting Rampant Growth on turn 2, for example, that takes you to 3 lands. Cultivate on turn 3 takes you to 5 lands. We're probably looking at like turn 5 to turn 6 of being able to cast Omnath and then get 2 to 3 tokens alongside of him. Another good example is in Korvold, Fae Cursed King. He gets value immediately when you cast him. If you're planning to win off commander damage, Korvold generally presents a 3-turn clock to an opponent, who draws you buckets of cards along the way. Korvold being in Jund means it's often going to be very fast to come down, rarely being cast after turn 4. Once you're able to maintain card parity with the table by having Korvold draw at least 2 extra cards per turn, you're very likely going for it. Korvold is becoming extremely large, can threaten an opponent very easily, can knock them out quickly, and allows you to maintain card parity and eventually have true card advantage over the rest of the table. Muldrotha, the Gravetide, is another very popular commander who is often going to open up and begin dominating the board when she starts casting multiple cards out of her graveyard every turn. Once she starts a turn with a fetch land, as well as a creature and an artifact or an enchantment in the graveyard, she's going to start burying the table in value, and often setting opponents far behind with reusable removal. Again, being in green, we can probably plan to get in at least a turn or two ahead of what we would normally expect in terms of mana. So by the turn we cast Muldrotha, we're probably not going to get too far ahead. But apart from that, maybe replaying a fetch land, we'd probably look at turn 5, when Muldrotha's really going to start paying us off by allowing us to multi-spell using the resources in our graveyard. Taking a look at an old favorite, we also have Krenko Mob Boss. He doesn't usually get a lot of powerful ramp outside of Mana Rocks, and the critical turn for Krenko is generally when you can start your turn ready to activate his tap ability and generate piles of goblin tokens, especially when you've teamed him up with something like Purphoros or Impact Tremors to deal massive amounts of damage to the table. Assuming this deck can land at least one piece of ramp during the setup stage of the game, we're probably looking to land Krenko on turn 3, and then start activating him on turn 4 or later. Being in mono red, the deck does lack some consistency with being able to find those enchantments like Purphoros or Impact Tremors. But sometimes, just having a giant field of goblins is enough to put the game to a close. So, how do we actually talk about the critical turn? How do we use this information as part of our Rule Zero conversation? You want to identify your deck's critical turn, as well as how your deck is going to be going for it in the first place. You may say, my deck can start to go for it on turn 5, but it takes 3 turns to knock somebody out of the game when I start swinging with my commander. This informs your opponents that you're planning to play a Voltron-style deck. While your deck may take a little while to get going, it can, relatively quickly, begin knocking opponents out of the game. You're letting them know that they should expect to need to interact as early as turn 5 when you're starting to swing with your Voltron commander. If I were presenting my O God Eternal Oketra deck, I would say, my critical turn is around turn 6. That's when I'm usually able to put Oketra onto the battlefield and start casting at least 2 creature spells per turn in order to start generating large numbers of zombies. It usually takes me longer than that to find the combo pieces I need to truly put together a game-winning combo, but I can usually bury my opponents in 4/4s by about turn 6. That's when the avalanche begins. If I were describing my old friend Torbran, Thane of Redfell, I would identify that as early as turn 4, I can be threatening significant amounts of damage, and I would put the clock at about 3 for Torbran as well. Torbran is significantly quicker than Oketra. It is also significantly more vulnerable. A single good board wipe is usually enough to set Torbran very far behind, and even point removal, removing my commander, is enough to put me more than a half step back from my opponents, because now my dinky little 1/1s are just that, dinky little 1/1s again. Now, does this mismatch mean that Oketra and Torbran can't sit at the same table? I don't think so. Oketra just needs to be able to recognize that it needs to be set up by turn 4. Once Torbran hits the battlefield, Oketra needs to be able to interact with Torbran's game plan. Even if Oketra herself is not going for it at that point, she at least needs to be set up enough to be able to interact meaningfully. And that is where the role of the critical turn comes into play. Hey, don't plan to tap out on turn 4 and expect you're not going to take a bunch of damage from my goblin tokens that Torbran is buffing. So as we start to head back to the friendly local gaming stores, and as we start to see more and more in-person play starting again, let's brush up on our Rule Zero conversations. Let's have an idea for how to present our decks to our opponents to get us the best possible games of Commander we can enjoy. I think the whole concept of having a sneaky deck with a win condition that you're not going to tell people how your deck works, I honestly think that this is a relic of a bygone age in Commander. Decks have become diverse enough at this point where not sharing that information, it kind of does the same disservice as trying to play secret commanders with people. It defeats the entire purpose of the Rule Zero conversation. And I think, particularly when you're playing with a new playgroup or people you haven't seen in a long amount of time, I think it's worth it to sit down and have that conversation. Be the person who sets the good example and says, this is my deck's critical turn. This is my deck's clock. This is how it tries to win. I think that is going to get you more good games of Commander than any number of wins you might be able to sneak by playing some kind of weird little combo that people haven't seen before. What do you think? What is your deck's critical turn? How does your deck go for it? Let us know in the comments. You can add us on Twitter, where we are at GemstoneMineMTG, or you can send us an email at gemstonemindpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, I'm John, this is Gemstone Mine, wishing you a happy and healthy return to in-person play. You can reach the crew from Gemstone Mine on Twitter at GemstoneMineMTG, or send us an email at gemstonemindpodcast@gmail.com. On YouTube, we're Gemstone Mine Podcast. Be sure to like, subscribe, and hit the notification bell.